Hey, everyone, this is David Greene. I'm the former host of NPR's Morning Edition, and I want to welcome you to Left, Right, and Center. This is your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate the political debate. We are several weeks in now to this potential conflict on the Ukrainian-Russian border. World leaders have been trying to quell these tensions, but troops on both sides are continuing to prepare for a possible Russian invasion. We also have heard Russian and Chinese leaders declaring this week that their partnership is essentially going to establish a new world order, which sounds pretty ominous. So why is the United States responding less forcefully than some are calling for to this threat? Well, among other things, we should remember that Russia supplies 40% of Europe's natural gas, which means, of course, that there are NATO allies who are particularly vulnerable if these relations stay icy. So a lot to talk about here as we dig in. I want to bring in our left, right, and center panel to talk it through. I am your guest host, and I am at the center. On the left, we have Moa Lathy back. He's the executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. Hi, Mo.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for coming back. I'm glad we're back at it again. And on the right today, we are joined by Tara Setmayer. She is a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. She's a former GOP communications director on Capitol Hill and also a University of Virginia Center for Politics resident scholar. Tara, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Tara, I'm going to put you on the spot first, since you're joining us, and Mo and I have been here for a few weeks together. But what are your general impressions right now of how the United States is handling this frightening tension with Russia and Ukraine?
Well, I think that lessons have been learned. Well, I'm hoping that lessons have been learned from the response to Russia's aggression in 2014 when they annexed Crimea. It was a rather weak response by the Obama administration at the time. It seemed as though they were caught a bit flat-footed. And it this seems to be an extension of Putin's desires to have dominance again in that region. And he smells potential weakness internationally, which is why he may be engaged in this now. I'm encouraged by Joe Biden committing to using the most fierce sanctions that anyone has ever seen, he claims. I hope that they live up to that, because there has to be a price. I worry about what the security posture looks like internationally if the United States does not act with swift and certain and unified response with NATO and Europe. China is watching. We've seen the way China has grown in the region. We were watching Putin and Xi Jinping become more powerful political allies. And China has its own hegemonic desires, and we see what's happening with Taiwan. And I'm concerned that if the United States does not handle this with Putin in case he does invade, that can send a signal to not only our allies that there's some weakness here, but also to our enemies that now is the time for them to act on their aggressions.
What exactly would you be calling for, though, if you're saying that the Biden administration and NATO should draw lessons from Russia annexing Crimea? You say, you know, sanctions that are as tough as possible. Is that enough? Or do you think the United States and NATO should be considering something, you know, even bolder that would involve troops or something else?
I don't think the political environment in the United States would allow for an actual kinetic troop involvement in Europe. But a recent Morning Consult political poll showed that 48% of Americans were okay with us sending troops there to bolster NATO. So we're hoping it doesn't have to get there. What are some of the things that they could do? Well, they could actually take a lesson from the Trump administration, where they instituted sanctions against technology companies in China like Huawei. They could do something similar with Russia, institute sanctions where Russia doesn't have access to technologies and industries that are important to them, like defense industries. They could make sure that that their financial transactions internationally are interrupted, sarin debt payments, go after Putin and his cronies and freeze their assets. There are things that they can do that could make this, on top of the Nord Stream too, also the energy aspect of this, which is probably the most politically explosive part of this, the most politically leveraging aspect of what's going on, but also look at where we have leverage in the energy industry and not be afraid to use it, because Russia has politically weaponized energy in the past. They're not afraid to do that. We need to have a counter for it.
Mo, where are you when it comes to energy in this whole crisis? I mean, the reality is that a lot of Europe relies on Russian energy, and there's a lot at stake in a lot of countries for people being able to keep the power running at affordable prices. But how does that play into decisions by NATO countries and the United States on what to do here?
Yeah, I think Tara's right that it is one of the more politically volatile parts of this. I was heartened, when in the past week the president stood side by side with the German chancellor, and they both signaled that there would be a unified response. Even when pushed on Nord Stream, they didn't respond invoking that name, but they said there will be a unified response. And that was the one thing I've been the most worried about, is, there has to be a unified response and a unified front from the NATO allies. Can't see any cracks in that armor. This is the one crack I've been the most concerned about. Look, Europe wants Russia's energy, right? They want this stuff, but the one thing they want, maybe the one thing they want more, is to contain any sort of Russian aggression. It is in no one's interest in Europe to see Russia make moves like this. All of our allies understand the importance of containing this. And look, frankly, Russia wants this pipeline as much, if not more, than the Europeans do. And so continuing to put that pressure on is critical. Continuing to put the threat of severe economic sanctions is going to be critical. I think the idea of targeting certain Russian companies is worth exploring.
And Putin's cronies, as Tara said.
That's right. And look, the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians have proven in recent years that sort of the global battlefield isn't always fought using traditional troops, that their ability to engage and willingness to engage in cyber warfare, for example, is incredibly important. And so, the United States being able to sort of shift the theater of combat, so to speak, and engage on some of these, and sort of hold that out there, I think is another point of leverage.
You can still look tough in this world today and not necessarily have troops on the ground.
Because at the end of the day, I don't know that there is the political will amongst the American voters for us to put troops on the ground and engage in a traditional hot war. But that doesn't mean that there aren't ways that we can put pressure on the Russians.
But when we talk about the NATO alliance, I mean, we're bringing up Nord Stream, this project, natural gas pipelines running from Russia to Germany. I mean, the United States and Germany can talk all they want now, but aren't we not at the point where push might come to shove? Where, I mean, like, if there is an invasion and the Biden administration has to think about whether to call for cutting off the Nord Stream project and the Germans desperately need that energy, isn't that when the alliance is really going to be tested?
100%.
Yeah. we all agree that tough moment could be coming.
That could be coming. But I think, the fact, we just saw this argument in the Senate where Senator Cruz and some others tried to impose sanctions in advance. And I thought the Biden administration's response was the right one, which is once we do that, we lose our leverage. It is the threat of the sanctions before an invasion that is more likely to hold off an invasion than launching them now, giving away any incentive for them to pull back. So I do think, that this has, surprisingly to me, been an area where you have seen a little bit more bipartisanship than we're used to seeing in the response. The Biden administration's approach has been applauded by, people like Senator McConnell and others. But being unified both at home and with our allies is going to be the key.
But it involves more than that, because it's the EU has to have unanimity to agree on sanctions for the Nord Stream project. So that's 27 member states. And you have member states like Austria and Bulgaria who are nervous about antagonizing Moscow because they're a group of 10 countries that have over 75% of their natural gas dependency is on Russia.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is an internal struggle within the EU as well that extends beyond just Germany. I mean, the Nord Stream pipeline is 750 miles from Germany, from Russia to Germany, goes through the Baltic Sea, bypasses Ukraine, which hasn't made the Ukrainians very happy because they lose out on those lucrative transit fees. But it's still that point of leverage of the Nord Stream project is that it's still not approved by European regulators.
And there's so many different agendas, I mean, in Europe.
That's right.
And that, I feel like, is where Russia and China are, that's what they're trying to exploit. They're trying to say, all of you are struggling to keep your alliance together. Now we're going to join forces and basically say that we have the right to take over the world, which that's what is kind of freaking me out, that, you know, Russia and China, these are not natural allies, but they are using this moment. They put out this joint statement in English on the Kremlin website, which is not always what they do. So you could tell what audience they were going after. And the one of the phrases that really stood out to me is in that statement, China and Russia, quote, believe that the advocacy of democracy and human rights must not be used to put pressure on other countries. Like, they're trying to change this whole narrative, not about the fact that Putin has 100,000 troops that are threatening a country that might have to defend itself, but trying to say, like, hey, you know, there are different kinds of democracy. Don't lecture us. But I don't know. What do you both think that statement and that alliance, whether it's true or not, says about this moment and what might be ahead, Tara?
Listen, dictators are going to dictate. Right? That's what they do.
Yeah, yeah.
This is part of their propaganda tactics, which is a signature characteristic of authoritarian regimes. They try to turn the narrative around to best suit their interests and gaslight the rest of the world. We all see what's going on with China and Russia, and we see why that alliance now against Western-style democracy is becoming a formidable opponent, because they know that separate, they can't take us on, but together, it's much more of a challenge. What's happening with China, I think, has been overshadowed by a lot of other issues here, but another aspect of their alliance, Russia and China just signed a 30-year contract to supply gas and energy to China, Russia and China, and to build a pipeline there.
Which means Russia might not need Europe as much as
that's
in terms
correct.
Of consumers of their energy. Yeah,
that's right. So Russia sees the long-term plan here that, okay, if the West is going to try to isolate us, then we're going to team up with our ally over here, who's also being isolated by the West to some degree because of their actions on human rights and other military aggression in the South China Sea. Then we won't need them, and that's a problem. Same thing with Russia trying to convert some of its foreign currency, taking it outside of the West. They're looking to China. It's the next natural market for that. So, you know, we need to pay close attention to what they're doing. When China saw what happened with the disastrous Afghanistan withdrawal over the summer, they launched one of the largest incursions into Taiwan. We know that's considered disputed territory with them. The United States considers Taiwan a non-NATO ally, along with, not formally, but informally, a non-NATO ally, along with New Zealand, Australia, Japan, South Korea. Those types of strategic security alliances matter in the world. And China sees a potential opening here as they become more and more emboldened with their relationship with Russia.
Yeah.
And if they perceive weakness on the part of the U.S. and Western-style strategic alliances. So we have to pay close attention to what they're doing.
Mo, before we move on, can you tell us anything that would calm us down a little bit and maybe mean that we shouldn't be freaking out about this Russia-China alliance, or is this really terrifying?
We should freak out about it, right? Like, no one wants to see that alliance grow in power and strength. I will say, though, that even as they gravitate more closely to one another, those are two regimes that do have a long history of distrust between of one another. So that's not to say that the alliance couldn't stand, but they're never going to be fully trusting of one another. I also think that even as they gravitate closer to one another, even if they need to rely on the West a little bit less when it comes to energy, they still need to rely on the West. Russia's economy is not what you would call, you know, on solid footing. They cannot afford to close off their energy to the entire West without it having severe economic implications back home. I think that alliance is one that we should always be concerned about, but I still think we hold some cards here that Russia has to pay attention to.
The U.S. and the West still have a good bit of leverage. All right, we will move on, and I'm sure be coming back to this topic in coming weeks. But for now, we're going to move on. We'll be back with Tara Setmayer and Mo Alethi to talk about if and when we can get rid of these masks. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
This is Left, Right, and Center. We're changing things up, but always keeping it civilized yet provocative. Let us know what you want to hear or who you want to hear from. You can ask a question or leave a comment at kcrw.com/LRC.
All right, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am David Greene, the former host of Morning Edition at NPR. On the right, Tara Setmayer. She is senior advisor at the Lincoln Project and host of their show, The Breakdown. And on the left, Mo Alethi, former director of communications at the Democratic National Committee and now executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. And we are now also joined by Kimberly Atkins Storr. She's a senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe and also host of the legal podcast, #SistersInLaw. Thanks for joining us, Kim. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this week, I want to talk about masks. Everyone loves to talk about masks, right? I mean, cases of the Omicron variant have been subsiding. We've seen some Democratic governors declare an end to mask mandates, including here in California, where I am. Before now, it's been mostly Republican governors who have refused to impose mask mandates at all. And of course, the rules have been influenced by politics in various regions in the country, not necessarily case levels. So now we're in this point where masking rules are going to be made by local officials, presumably relying on a combination of factors to make these decisions, from case levels to vaccination rates and sadly to political pressures. So, Kim, let me just bring you in here. Is local politics, is the local level the place where mask rules should be made as we are hopefully, fingers crossed, emerging from this pandemic?
I think in a perfect world, no, it would be great to have really clear, easy to understand national guidelines coming from places like the CDC. But we do not have that. And we have not had that for the duration of this pandemic. And so I think that local is the only way to go. There are advantages to people making these decisions on a local level. It's because you can only they can assess where they are, how well efforts to impose restrictions over the past 3 years, for past couple of years, through various things like the Omicron variant, how well those things have worked. And if they have shown that locally there are the numbers support lifting some of these mandates, then that's something that they should do. But I think the problem and the reason that you see some of these states moving forward, even against the advice of the CDC right now, is that there have been so much confusion from the top, from federal regulators. I'm somebody who pays attention to this kind of stuff for a living, and I still am unsure exactly where the guidance stands at this point, because it's never always made complete sense. So I understand if you have mayors and governors who are saying, look, we have done what we were supposed to do. Just like in places like Massachusetts, it does have a Republican governor, but I think it's fair to call that a blue state. I think one reason you're seeing them lift restrictions there is because the numbers overall stayed relatively low as compared to other places in the country throughout the pandemic. Yes, they struggled through the Omicron spike just like everybody else, but those numbers came down. The people, the residents did their part. They wore masks. They stayed away from each other. They got vaccinated in large measure. And so now it's time to say, you know, let people breathe a little more freely if they want to. Now, and this is coming from me. I'm somebody, politics aside, I have asthma. I'm afraid of COVID. And I have KN95s in every color to match every outfit.
You're going
to
make your decision. You want to feel safer and that's your decision.
Exactly. Yeah. Let me wear my mask if I want to. But if you are in a safe environment and you have done everything that you want, I think it's right. I think it is time for people to lift those mandates. And I still am firmly in favor of the vaccine mandate because I think that's what helped get us here. But for masking, I think that's the right thing.
Mo, is that a fair criticism of the CDC that they have just not been clear enough and it's left local officials right now, as we're seeing, to say like, okay, it's up to us. We got to make these decisions because we don't know anything from the top that's really helpful.
Yeah, I don't think clarity has been the CDC's strength throughout all of this. And I think the lack of, you know, as we were just talking about, the lack of a uniform federal response going back to the earliest days of the pandemic in the Trump administration, where there was an unwillingness to have a unified response throughout the early days of the Biden administration, where the political realities wouldn't necessarily allow unified political response, has further complicated this. Look, for me, I think what it comes down to is the turning point has been kids. As you know, the youngest kids under two still are not able to get vaccinated.
Right.
But once, you know, five and up were able to get vaccinated, you started seeing a whole lot of people who had been the good soldiers, had followed the mandates, had all of them, start to say, all right, now I think we can step out into the world a little bit more. That's why you're seeing in a lot of places these vicious political fights over schools. Those fights have just intensified in a lot of places because a lot of the parents who at one point were willing to kind of, you know, sort of take the medicine and follow, you know, all the guidance, suddenly are like, okay, the kids are vaccinated, like keep them in school. And I get that, right? As a parent of two young kids, right? Like if my kids have to go home again because of a scare, like I'm going to, you know, we're all going to lose our minds.
But when you say the turning point has been schools, what do you mean that the turning point was kids?
Yeah, no, the turning point being that there was less the political and I think the day-to-day calculus has shifted from the public health consideration in the minds of many Americans and has shifted now towards how much is this going to disrupt my life? That was the shift in mentality. More people, I think, now are, no one's completely unconcerned about the public health ramifications, but there's a growing number of people who say, okay, it is time to live with it. It is time to understand how we can move forward and not remain crippled as a society by it. There is critical mass of folks in my community and in my neighborhood who are now vaccinated and boosted, and we should be able to go about our lives.
But why aren't we seeing that in school systems? I mean, it's so interesting that the shift you're saying is happening, and you know, we've seen mask mandates starting to end, and you know, businesses and restaurants in some places. But it feels like there's some places where schools are the last place where they're taking masks off. And you know, there's this big debate over the health of kids and teachers' unions and everything, obviously all critically important. And people should have the right to wear masks whenever they want to, but there are a lot of experts who say that the emotional toll and the social toll on kids when they're still forced to wear masks is really important. Who is fighting for the kids? Like, is there a kid lobby? Like, there is a restaurant lobby and lobbies for other businesses and places? It just seems like a different world when it comes to schools and these decisions.
I think you could say that the parents are the kids' lobby. Right. I mean, parents are the ones who are most directly involved in making the decision for their children. But the problem here goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier in the conversation. the mixed messaging coming from the CDC and from public health officials about masking and about, you know, what kind of masks and is it high quality masks and the argument over whether they work or whether they don't. And I mean, it people have become numb to this now and they are over it. They're over this COVID-19 thing. And they said, all right, we got our vaccinations. Let's get back to normal. To Mo's point, some people are saying we're ready to live with it. But to Kimberly's point, I share her COVID responsibility here. I'm asthmatic as well. I will continue to wear my N95 masks anywhere indoors because I'm not willing to take that risk. And I'm not willing to compromise my mom either, who's immunocompromised. So the issue here with kids in schools, though, it has become a political issue. There are many medical professionals who think that the lifting of these mask mandates is premature, particularly in schools. You only have 22% of Americans between 5 and 11 that are currently vaccinated. Only 56% between the ages of 12 and 17. That's according to the CDC. That is not enough to warrant taking masks off for everyone and keep everyone healthy, according to a lot of medical experts. So, I mean, there's examples throughout the country. One example in Wyoming, in Laramie, which is a great place. If anyone's ever visited there, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But in Laramie, Wyoming, last month, they had 400 students and 100 staff test positive within a week and a half once they decided to get rid of masks in schools. So an issue like that happened in Kimberly's home state in Massachusetts up there, something similar. They saw a rise in cases. And so is this really about what's in the best interest of public health? Or is it just the political fatigue that parents, particularly suburban women, who are an imperative constituency for Democrats going into the midterm elections, is this group revolting against Democrats because of the pandemic policy? I would suspect that the Biden administration and Democrats have polled. They see what's going on. They saw what happened in New Jersey. They saw what happened in Virginia in particular when it came to school policies. And you saw a lot of suburban women break ranks with the Democrats to vote for Republicans who said that they would not close schools and they would release some of these mandates. Wow. This is a political problem for Democrats, and they're trying to balance it.
It's so sad when we talk about a public health crisis in the politics, but I guess the party's just, I mean, that's the reality. But can I ask you, I'm so fascinated that you, Kimberly, and you, Tara, have, you have your own health reasons to keep the mask on. And I wonder if one of the considerations when it comes to schools, it's like, if you lift a mask mandate, it makes it harder for a child or a child and their family to wear a mask because you might get ridiculed. You might, you know, be singled out for being sick. And I mean, it just invites all sorts of problems. And schools are under this pressure to say, like, you know, it has to be, you know, if we're still at a point where a few kids have to wear a mask, then we need to keep this mandate in place because we don't want that discomfort. And just thinking that through right now, as you both described, like that's a hard kind of thing to grapple with.
Well, I'm not sure that it's that hard. I mean, I think it's just as easy as Tara and I said, is that we have the choice to wear these masks because we have our own considerations. What I'm far more worried about are the states in which it is prohibited for students in universities and other public places to wear masks. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. You can't even ask a student to put a mask on if you, as a teacher, for example, have a condition or you have an immunocompromised person in your home. I think that's where the problem lies. I've had to do things differently my entire life because of my asthma, being the one who has to wear a mask sometimes when I'm too close to too many people wouldn't have been that much different. And I think having that allowance is totally fine. But I think for the mandate, and honestly, yes, I get the points about Democrats probably doing their polling and realizing that this is a tough issue. I know the parents that I know are, all the Democrat parents that I know are tired of these mandates too. They want their kids in school. They want their kids in sports. They want them to be able to play musical instruments. They want them to have a fulsome school experience, and they want to move forward. They want to get to the point that this is an endemic. Yes, we'll have to still live with it, but that the kids aren't paying such a heavy price that they have been paying.
it is a political reality. It is people that were once solidly behind all of the mandates are now beginning to waver on the mandates because there are other considerations that are now more important, right? It is more important to me, there are a lot of parents out there who would say, it is more important that my kids stay in school. I care less about the mask. As long as they stay in school, as long as the school doesn't shut down, because we have to get back to our lives.
What I find frustrating about the mask conversation versus the vaccine one, which obviously I'm pro-vaccine, I'm pro-science, and I'm grateful that we have these life-saving measures in place. But the mask, not wearing a mask and the argument around this seems so counterintuitive to me, where we all know this is an airborne disease and that it's scientifically proven that masks help stop the spread. It's a very simple thing to do. And yet there is this national outcry about, well, I'm tired of doing it, or, you know, why do we still have to do this? It's like arguing that, why do we have to have tires on our car? Why do we have to have brakes on our car? You know, it's like, it's something that seems so obvious to me. And, you know, if you look at public health experts, like, for example, Dr. Stanley Weiss, he's a professor of biostatistics and epidemiology at Rutgers. And he said that all of this is clearly politically motivated because it's not scientifically based to get rid of the simplest tool to stop an airborne, the transmission of an airborne disease.
But the freedom argument, what about the people who say it is my choice? I live in the United States of America. I'm free and no one's going to tell me how to protect myself and my family. I will make this choice. I'm not saying I agree with that.
Well, here's the difference, right? Here's the difference. The difference is that their choice impacts other people. So yes, they're free to not have to wear a mask as long as it doesn't impact other people. I mean, there are plenty of things that we can say we're free to do, but you're not allowed to do them in the United States because it can endanger the lives of others. That's what it's about. If you want to risk it, that's fine, except that we don't have the luxury of that. The coronavirus doesn't care whether you're free or not, or a Democrat or a Republican. It doesn't matter. It's a disease that impacts everyone. And the idea of the selfish idea, I think, of, well, it's my choice. Yeah, except that it's kind of like secondhand smoke. It's your choice if you want to smoke, but there's a reason why we have rules about smoking for those of us who don't want to. It impacts everyone.
My challenge is that all of this talk in the recent weeks about the mask mandates has decreased the conversation about the importance of vaccination.
Yeah.
And like, the more we need to get back to that conversation. There's still too many people out there who aren't even getting the vaccine. We still need to increase that number.
Not that that's a conversation that can happen in the absence of politics either, but yes, I mean, right. Shifting back to that, especially in this moment, would be really important and help all of us, I think. Okay, talking to Mo Alathy, Tara Settmeyer, and Kimberly Atkins-Store, we're going to come back and talk about the Supreme Court. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
New year, new show. We're making changes to Left, Right, and Center, and you can weigh in. Leave a comment or ask us a question at kcrw.com/LRC.
All right, we are back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am your host, David Green, the former host of NPR's Morning Edition. On the right, we have Tara Settmeyer of the Lincoln Project. On the left, Mo Alathy, Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. And our special guest is Kimberly Atkins-Store. She's an opinion writer for the Boston Globe, also hosts the legal podcast Hashtag Sisters-in-Law. So President Biden campaigned on this promise that if he had the chance to nominate a justice to the Supreme Court, he would name an African-American woman. When Justice Stephen Breyer announced 2 weeks ago that he'd be stepping down, Biden confirmed that he plans to follow through on that pledge. Kimberly Atkins-Store, you wrote a column recently saying that the women whose names are being floated at the top of Biden's list to be nominated are beyond qualified because, as you put it, they have become agile hurdlers of the invisible barriers placed before them every day of their professional lives. And you made this personal and said that you've experienced a lot of what they have experienced in their legal careers. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so it seems that the opposition already to Biden's nominee, even before we have a nominee, is centered around qualification, that somehow because Biden made this pledge, it either ensures that the candidate will be not the best qualified, or it's insulting to them somehow, to Black women, to say that, you know, I'm making sure that Black women are represented on the court is somehow reflects the fact that they truly are unqualified. It really begs the question in an awful way. But it's important to note that not only are, as we said, all of the women whose names have been discussed, they are all qualified. They are federal judges, state judges, law professors. They've led civil rights litigation organizations. They're supremely qualified. And in order to get to wherever they are individually, they have not only had to work harder, be better, overcome things like economic differences that made school in general, and certainly law school, more expensive to them, harder to access. Black people generally take on more student loans, resulting in a lifetime of more debt. But they have had to endure throughout their careers the daily little indignities that Black women in professional spaces, including in the law, suffer. I know when I was a litigator in Boston, I used to go to court a lot. I had the dream job. That was the job that I wanted in law. But every time I checked in to argue a case at the trial court, I was asked if I was represented by counsel. I was directed toward the criminal division because I was mistaken for a criminal defendant.
Oh, God.
Once an attorney came into my office and, you know, handed me a stack of papers and asked if I can make copies. It's this assumption that when they see a Black woman in this space, they already identify who we are or what they think we're capable of.
And you would face
and
that repeatedly.
Constantly, right. And we're constantly having to do our jobs while proving that we deserve them. So that's a skill that you do that long enough. That's a skill. And I know that when whoever the nominee is at her confirmation hearing, that skill will help her deflect any attack on her qualifications that she will face. But it's a shame that they all have to have that additional skill.
Well, can I ask you, in the context of everything you just talked about, I mean, President Biden has been criticized by some who say that this pledge actually demeans Black women because there's an inherent suggestion that these candidates would need help to be in the competition and can't just compete against everyone on their own. I mean, how do you feel about that when you hear it?
Well, any reason that they would need help to be in the competition, so to speak, is because of the systemic biases that have kept them out, that have kept them from competing for hundreds of years, right? It's just Joe Biden saying, oh, I recognize that, so I'm going to make sure that this is a candidate. I say it's about time to have a Black woman. I mean, Black women are 6% of the U.S. population and have always been 0% of the U.S. Supreme Court. Yet the cases that are being decided, so many of them, whether it's about health care, voting rights, affirmative action, abortion rights, all of them, when you look at the statistics, Black women are affected by a disproportionate amount. And so certainly you should have a representation. The Supreme Court should look as much as possible like the country at large, and certainly should look like the people whose decisions they affect. And they should be able to bring that lived experience to making those decisions. The fact that that hasn't happened now is a problem with the system and the structure. The fact that the president is now saying, I'm going to directly intervene to try to fix that to the extent that I can, isn't that's not insulting to Black women. The system that puts them at the disadvantage so that there are so few Black women judges in the country today, that's the part that's insulting.
Tara, how is what Kimberly is saying landing with you?
I mean, she makes a very compelling argument. As a conservative and a woman of color, I've struggled with the affirmative action discussions based on race and gender over the years for the reasons that you cited, where I don't want anyone ever questioning my qualifications or whether I deserve to be there or because of some quota program that people felt they needed. I wanted to be there based on my merits. But, you know, as I've gone through life and I've evolved a little bit on some of this issue, I still think that environment and social economic status has a lot of impact on education and those types of opportunities. But I think that's a different discussion. In this instance, you know, the idea of having representation and lived experience on the Supreme Court is really important. If we look at history and what the Supreme Court, the makeup of the Supreme Court for so long, the absence of women, the absence of people of color for decades, impacted the rulings and impacted the lives of these people, of these groups in the United States that were oppressed and didn't have the same rights for so long because of the lack, I think, of having people with those lived experiences on the court. This has not been a problem. I'm looking at Republicans and conservatives now, and you know, I consider myself to be a constitutional conservative and an originalist, and I really don't want judges, the litmus test of judges, to be to interpret the Constitution outside of what was originally intended, the activist jurist argument. However, I think that this outrage by some of the Republican senators is a furtherance of this cultural wedge that they're using, particularly when it comes to race and culture in this country. They know that this is a powerful tool. Republicans are the masters at the cottage industry of ginning up the Supreme Court nomination issue as a base, animating their base to get them to go out and say, oh my gosh, you know, the Supreme Court, this is the most important thing for a president to do. We need to, you know, they're single issue voters. A lot of evangelical Christians were willing to cast aside all of Donald Trump's transgressions because they wanted him to be the person that you know, gets the Supreme Court nominations, and they got three of them. So elections have consequences, but Republicans are really, really good at creating this cottage industry around the politicization of Supreme Court nominees. And they didn't have a problem when Ronald Reagan said that he would appoint the first woman to the Supreme Court with Sandra Day O'Connor. They applauded it. They didn't have a problem when it was Clarence Thomas replacing the first Black Supreme Court justice and Thurgood Marshall. They applauded it. It's okay. Would they feel the same way if Janice Rogers Brown, who was a Black conservative judge that Republicans heralded for years and were happy with her rise in judicial ranks, would they be complaining then? I don't think so. It is a politically convenient argument for them to go after Biden and use the race aspect of this because they know that gins people up, unfortunately, and even more so in this racially charged environment. If you look at what's on Fox News or on a lot of the right-wing ecosystem media, this idea of white replacement and the demographic changes in America, they have been exploiting this white grievance for a long time. And now this is another way for them to use that politically to get their base excited and out voting against Democrats.
I feel like we should spend an entire show talking about just this topic. There's so much here. Mo, let me just give you, I'm curious how you're reacting to all this.
I couldn't agree more with both Kim and Tara. And, you know, I was going to make the same point about the very people who are loudly denouncing this being silent and applauding Ronald Reagan for keeping his campaign promise with Sandra Day O'Connor. I think this is less about this particular court battle politically than it is the bigger political battle. I actually expect that this will be one of the least contentious confirmations that we have seen in recent years. You know, Merrick Garland was an ugly confirm, or wasn't even a confirmation battle, right? Like, he didn't even get a hearing. Kavanaugh and Comey Barrett, those were incredibly contentious confirmation processes. I don't think this one will be as much so, in part because it's not really going to change the dynamic of the court, the composition of the court in the context of liberal versus conservative. Conservatives already have a strong majority, and that's not being threatened. And you're even beginning to see signs of that. People like Lindsey Graham this week coming out in favor of one of the names that is reportedly on Biden's shortlist. So I don't think this is going to be an ugly confirmation hearing, but I think it is going to be an opportunity to further the grievance politics that Tara was just talking about, which seems central and core to the Republican political strategy writ large. It will be something they will be able to talk about in the run-up to the midterms. It will be something they're able to talk about in as the next presidential campaign begins to take shape after the midterms. So much of our politics today is being driven by the otherization of our politics. My people are feeling left behind and threatened because everyone is helping everybody else's people. And I'm losing my power. I am losing my agency. I am losing my sense of security in a rapidly changing world. And that's frightening to many folks. And I think the current Republican leadership banks on that. They bank on that fear. They bank on that fear of being othered out of power. Mm. And so that's what this is going to be. It's going to be less about who the actual person is that sits on the court.
Which is a shame, because that's what largely it should be about. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. But wow, we could really go on for a much longer time on this topic. All right. Our special guest this week has been Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Thanks so much for being here with us, Kim.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. And let's start with Mo Alathy. It is your soapbox, Mo.
I am getting increasingly tired of the fake political apology. We see it all the time. Politician makes a boneheaded move and they go out there after a day or so of getting beat up in the press over it and finally decide to apologize. And the apology typically sounds like this: I am sorry that people took my boneheaded move the wrong way. That is not an apology. When we see it across the political spectrum, whether it's the politician who is caught not wearing a mask in a place where they're supposed to be wearing a mask, or whether it's the politician who puts out an incendiary comment or terrible anime video, if you made a mistake, own it. Go out there, say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done it, and people will tend to forgive. They tend to turn the corner. At the very least, it tends to be less of a news story. But this fake apology thing just adds to people's cynicism. It keeps the story going in the press. It's got to end.
Tara Settmayer, what's your rant?
My rant this week is about journalists and tell-all books. I am really sick and tired of this cottage industry of Trump insider books that are coming out with journalists trying to one-up the other on scoops that could potentially have legal implications. So many of these journalists who were on the president's beat for years seem to hold back some of the more explosive information in order to sell books. And I just think that there is a responsibility, especially if you are in journalism, there is a responsibility in the industry to hold powers accountable. The powers that be should be held accountable. That should be the number one job of a journalist, is to inform the American people so that powers can be held accountable. I just don't think that it's a good look for we have a cadre of excellent political journalists, but I just don't think it's a good look for them to withhold that kind of information if it's uncovered during research for their book in order to protect their bottom line. So come on, journalists, let's do better.
Okay. And lastly, here's what's on my mind today. I want to talk about building bridges. And I don't mean in politics. I mean actual bridges, because two bridges have caught my attention. One in Pittsburgh, my hometown, that collapsed, ironically, on a day when President Biden was visiting to talk about what else? Infrastructure. There are questions about how long the rebuilding is going to take, but that project did get $25 million in federal grant money to help. $25 million. That is 1/20 of what Amazon founder Jeff Bezos spent on a new yacht, whose travel out of the Dutch city of Rotterdam could require the intentional dismantling of a bridge. Yes, Bezos reportedly would pay and the bridge would be quickly rebuilt, all happening, I presume, with much greater efficiency and less red tape than the effort to rebuild a Pennsylvania bridge that came down on its own. I feel like I have made my point and need to say no more. Okay, that is all the time we have for today. I want to thank Tara Settmeyer, Moa Lathy, and Kimberly Atkins-Store. Well, now we want you to have time to make your point. Ask a question or leave a comment at kcrw.com/LRC. And thanks to everyone who's already dropped us a note. We have heard from a lot of folks. Some have said things like this. They want to hear more panelists outside of the major cities. Some of you have said you want to hear from more hardline conservatives. Others want more socialists. One person even asked for more of both, which I really like. Thanks to the listener who said this show, quote, helps me understand the people I disagree with. I really like that. And I do want to thank everyone who has welcomed me to the center seat. It's been a great time so far. I look forward to more. So keep these suggestions coming at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Nisha Venkats. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I am David Green. We really appreciate you being here and hope you tune in next week for a whole lot more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.